It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. He'll be back next week. Coming up, roughly 25% of rural Wisconsinites lack access to broadband internet. We'll talk about efforts to expand access and how high-speed internet can have a big impact on families, businesses, and communities as a whole. First, regardless of relationship status, this pandemic has caused a lot of shifts in the way we approach and think about love in our lives. Spending more time with a partner and less time out in the world has led to breakups for some, while others feel like they've grown closer together over the last year. For singles, the use of dating apps skyrocketed. In March of 2020, Tinder recorded its highest number of swipes per day at 3 billion. And yeah, that is billion with a B. OkCupid reported a 700% increase in the number of dates in a three-month period starting in March of last year. And Bumble saw video calls increase by 70%. And we're taking a look at how the pandemic has changed the way we date or approach love in any relationship, and we want to hear from you about your experiences at 800-642-1234. Did your relationship or dating life change throughout the pandemic? Did you go through a breakup? Did you start a new relationship? Did the time during the pandemic help or hurt your current relationship? How has it changed how you think overall about love? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Arielle Cooperberg is an associate professor of sociology and women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Her research interests include romantic partnerships, marriage, and dating. Arielle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so thinking all the way back to the actual stay-at-home part of this pandemic experience, you know, up until now, so it's been about a year and a half, let's just start talking about how much dating app usage increased. What do we know about how this has fluctuated pre-pandemic until today?
We know there's been a big increase in internet dating, in part because all the places where people used to meet dates have shut down during the pandemic. So my research has looked at where people, college students, meet dates, and most met them in class or at work or at bars and parties, all those things. Classes went home, work went virtual, bars shut down, parties should not have been happening, right? So they started shifting to meeting people online a lot more.
And do you think that in part because a lot of people had moved online anyway, that this was just sort of a natural extension of, well, maybe I'm single or maybe I'm maybe dating around a little, and this kind of filled the need a little for college students in particular?
Oh, yeah. They, you know, they can't meet people through other means. A lot of people felt very isolated, I think, especially if you're single. So this was, you know, everyone was going online anyway. And I think we've seen kind of a change in social norms about how acceptable it is to meet people on the internet, even compared to 2 years ago.
Yeah, hasn't there been, just even outside of sort of the college realm, a big increase in the online dating? It felt like maybe a decade ago, you might not admit that you met someone on, say, OkCupid, but now people are showing you their Tinder matches, maybe prior to the pandemic when you're meeting one-on-one, right?
Yeah, Tinder started about 10 years ago. Before that, you know, there weren't apps on your phone. It was more websites that you were going to. And there was still a lot of stigma around it. I remember I actually met my spouse on OkCupid in 2007, I think. And at first we told people we met through a friend because we didn't want to tell people we met online. So
if it makes you feel any better, I can admit the same thing, that I met my now husband on OkCupid and we've been together for about 10 years. And yeah, did not tell people maybe up until now that that's where we met. So I think a lot of us are in the same boat there. You know, what about people who were in somewhat new relationships at the beginning of all of this, this being the pandemic? Are we starting to see some new and emerging patterns from, you know, last March to now?
Yeah, so I've been doing interviews and collecting surveys with college graduates and college students over the last year. And some of what we saw was we had one interviewee who started a relationship about 2 months before the pandemic. Then the pandemic happened. They decided to co-quarantine, and their bubble was just the two of them pretty much. And they started getting very serious very quickly because that was the only in-person social interaction they were having. On the other hand, we had many people who said, I'm just not going to date until after the pandemic's over. And we saw an increase in the survey data. We had earlier collected a survey in 2017, which we were able to compare to, we being me and my colleague, Dr. Joan Mazzellis. And what we saw was there was an increase in people who were single, and there was a big decrease in casual dating. So relationships are about the same, right? People are still in serious romantic relationships at about the same rate, but casual dating has gone way down. We surveyed people in April of this year compared to 2017.
Now, you've also done research on cohabitation. Do you think that some people maybe accelerated their timeline to move in with someone because of the pandemic, because there was some concern about what the coming months would have brought last year?
Yeah, I think we actually directly asked about that in our survey, and we found it was about 5% of students and about 4% of college graduates said they moved in with a romantic partner sooner than they had expected. And in our interviews, some people talked about worrying about older family members they had been living with and wanting to protect them from COVID, so deciding to move in with their romantic partner. We also had, you know, that person who had a less serious relationship, and then she was like, basically, we're living together, but we have separate apartments still, when we interviewed her last year. So for some people, especially people who were already dating, I think it did accelerate relationships.
We are talking to Arielle Cooperberg. She is an associate professor of sociology in women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And her research interests include romantic partnerships, marriage, and dating. And that is what we are talking about right now. We're talking about how the pandemic as a whole has impacted relationships over the last, you know, year and a half. I want to take a caller right now. We have Johanna N. Adams. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, what did you want to talk about?
So I was with my partner. We got together at the beginning of the pandemic, and then we had broken up, I want to say in January, because it was just a really stressful time. I was working in the ER as a patient registrar in Milwaukee, because that's where I live now. We ended up getting back together, but it, like everyone said, our relationship was quit. And so, like, I really agree with that.
And Johanna, if I can ask you a follow-up question. We were just a moment ago talking about cohabitation. Did you happen to move in with your partner at the time, or were you still living separately? Okay.
We lived separately, and then in March, we moved in together. So this was, like, real pandemic time. Like, we just felt a lot of pressure to move in because we didn't, he had a bad situation, and we were just like, oh, we could just live together.
Yeah, well, Johanna, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And Arielle, did you hear similar instances of people who, I know we were just talking about cohabitation a second ago, but because of the pandemic, it really kind of pushed everyone maybe faster than normal, or that they just wanted to jump at the opportunity?
We did hear some people who wanted to jump at opportunities they had. It was interesting that the caller worked in healthcare, because we also had quite a few people who were partnered with people in healthcare and talked about the stress of having a partner who was working in the healthcare industry and managing all the COVID protections, especially early on when people didn't really know much about what was happening. But we also saw people breaking up because of COVID. So about 9% of college students said they had had a college breakup because of stress or distance, or, you know, disagreements over COVID as well.
Yeah. And it seems like the pandemic really did exacerbate things, maybe stressors that already would have been there, but really put it in maybe harsh relief for a lot of people. Do you think that the pandemic, for even people who might have had maybe stronger relationships, they weren't, you know, early in their relationships, but maybe exposed the cracks a little bit?
Yeah, I definitely think, first of all, it was a very high stress situation in many different respects. There were people who were losing jobs or getting paid less at jobs. So there was financial stress. There were people who were had jobs where they had to go and interact with the public. So there was the health stress. There was, you know, all school shutting down. So if you had children, there was a lot of stress around that. And I've seen other research that looks at stress specifically and said stress tended to go up. But there were also many people who said that COVID strengthened their marriage and made them appreciate their spouse more. You know, this was specifically about married people, but there were people in relationships who said, you know, in our study, who said, you know, if I didn't have this person, I probably would have moved in, you know, back home with my parents because I would have been so lonely. But this person was like, you know, my one social person who I was able to meet up with. So I think it's not as clear as saying, you know, everybody was more stressed. I think for some relationships, it made relationships stronger. Whenever we go through a big crisis, I think people look around and they kind of appreciate what they have more as well.
We are talking about how the pandemic has changed the way we date or think about the relationships in our lives. Our guest right now is Arielle Cooperberg. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And we want to invite you to join the conversation. The line is 800-642-1234. If you're single, has the pandemic changed your approach to dating? Do you look forward to, or have you been on some dates recently? And if you've been in a relationship or gone through a breakup, we want to hear about your experience. Or if maybe the pandemic strengthened your relationship, like we were just discussing, we want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Arielle Cooperberg, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She researches romantic partners and marriage, and we're talking about how the pandemic has changed the way we think about and approach love and relationships. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the pandemic has impacted the dynamic of your relationship? If you're single, did you choose to put your dating life on hold during the pandemic, or did you maybe find someone in the midst of all of this? Did you move in with maybe your parents and that made dating unrealistic? How overall has the pandemic changed your approach to love? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And I want to go to some of our callers right now. We have Erin in Madison. Hi, Erin.
Hi, how are you today? I just wanted to say that the pandemic has been really challenging. I was living in Chicago when it hit. My boyfriend was living in Milwaukee. We're both chefs, and we both lost our jobs like pretty immediately at the same time because we didn't know what the restrictions were going to be. We actually hunkered down at his parents in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. And then about a month later, after being furloughed and living with his folks, my boyfriend actually got diagnosed with leukemia. And so there was a lot going on at one time, and we had only been dating for about 4 months, but we were really serious about each other and just didn't really have an opportunity to figure out when and how we were going to move in together. So the pandemic actually kind of like, I don't want to say forced us together, but brought us together at a really opportune time. It was almost like it was in the stars. And ever since then, we had, you know, we both worked together to try to get money to make sure that he was healthy. And along with our family and friends, we stuck it out and we got married on May 15th.
Wow. Congratulations, Aaron, and the best of luck to you and your spouse with that that treatment for leukemia. And Ariel, we just heard from Aaron at 800-642-1234 sharing this story about it almost kind of felt like kismet in some ways that she met her now husband. A lot of things seemed to go wrong, but it seemed like they found the silver lining in all of this. Are you hearing any hopeful messages from respondents as you were doing your research?
Yeah. In our survey, about 3% of college graduates actually said they got married sooner than they had originally planned. We had like 4 to 5% saying they moved in sooner than they expected. So for some people, we had someone in our study was an international student, and his girlfriend had been in Korea and they were doing long distance. But during the pandemic, he moved back home and took virtual classes, so was able to kind of reunite with his partner. The group we're interviewing is a little younger. They're college students, so most of them are not at the age at which they're getting married. But we definitely have seen some relationships that kind of were able to get stronger as a result of the pandemic. And it's there in the survey data, too.
Aaron, thank you again so much for that call. And I want to take another caller now. We have Rohan in Milwaukee. Hi, Rohan.
Hi. So am I on?
Yes, you are.
I just wanted to observe that the sociologist listed all the many stressors that when you add them all together, it's pretty shocking. Yet the first stressor that I thought came to my mind is over 600,000 Americans died. So, millions of Americans are grieving. And I would think that this is difficult in the best of times to lose someone and be single. It really tests a relationship. But I also wonder how much worse it was with all these people who couldn't mourn with other people and in their traditional ways. And I'll listen to the response off on the radio.
Thank you so much for that question, Rohan. So one thing that we haven't really talked about is we've talked about the economic issues. We've talked about distance, stuff like that. But we're also in a period of collective trauma and collective grief. We have in the United States have had more than 600,000 people die. That's going to take a big mental toll on a lot of people, even if maybe you didn't lose someone. Do you think that there could be some long-term repercussions of how people may pursue romantic relationships kind of in light of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think I'm actually working on a study right now looking at how knowing people who were hospitalized or died because of COVID has affected mental health as part of this study. But I think definitely it can have two different kinds of effects. One is when people are grieving, they may pull back from other people and, you know, be like, I don't have time for relationships, especially if you have a close relative die. People are often, you know, there's a lot of kind of paperwork and stuff that happens afterwards. You may be packing up someone's home. So, and then grief itself, right? So people may not be interested in relationships. But on the other hand, it could also be bring people together in the relationships that they do have, or bring people, you know, new relationships if they meet other people who are going through similar grief. And one thing that's happening during the pandemic is I don't know anybody who hasn't been touched in some way by COVID. So we have this big unifying factor that everybody is kind of going through this shared traumatic experience. And, you know, as a sociologists looking at relationships, I would say that can help facilitate relationships if you're talking about a similar experience that you now went through and that we are all going through.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it, that we might be grieving all collectively, but that it could be a unifying thread in millions of people's lives moving forward, of course. One thing that strikes me too is that, you know, we've been talking about relationships, people that have broken up, people that have gotten together, maybe some people like Aaron who got married. But there's some people for whom they just didn't meet people either intentionally or otherwise and opted to remain single. Have we seen sort of norms or ideas around singledom change over the last year and a half?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I was single, I remember a lot of people always asking me about who I was dating and a lot of social pressure, especially as I was getting older. And I think people are more understanding now and saying, you know, oh, of course you're not dating. It's the middle of a pandemic. So, yeah, I'm not going to bother you about that.
So maybe the pressure that a lot of people felt kind of entitled to put on other people has maybe been maybe a silver lining there for those who are single. You know, one thing that has come up has been this idea of a baby boom. People thought during the pandemic that we would see just huge numbers of babies being born because people were at home with other people, and sometimes babies happen when people are together, just putting it out there. Did we ever see that?
No, we saw the opposite. And I could tell you, I did not expect there to be a baby boom during the pandemic. There's many reasons. Again, people are losing their jobs. When you've just lost your job, people aren't like, hey, now's the perfect time to have a baby. We also see increased stress. If you have a child, your children are home all the time now, so there's a lot less privacy to have a second child. So there's, you know, all sorts of things. And we've seen historically, whenever there's a lot of economic stress, birth rates go down. What I wouldn't be surprised to see is a post-pandemic baby boom, maybe 2 years from now. Because a lot of people have been putting off having children during the baby boom. We actually found in our study of graduates, it was 8% said they were putting off having children during the pandemic. And these were 2017 graduates, so people around their mid-20s. So all those 8% are putting it off now. But before now, you know, we had the Great Recession and the kind of after effects. I think a lot of millennials have been putting off having kids during the 2010s. And then this pandemic happened. And then, you know, people are getting older. So I would not be surprised if once things start recovering, then all these delayed babies start being born at once. That's actually how the first baby boom happened.
Yeah.
People delayed having kids during the Great Depression and then during World War II. And then World War II ended and they were like, okay, now's the time.
Ariel, thank you so much. We have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ariel Cooperberg is an associate professor of sociology and women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, caffeine is a big part of a lot of people's days, and new research is finding that the chemical may actually cause structural changes in the brain. Guest host Lee Rayburn talks to a scientist about what that may mean for our brains and our caffeine habit as a whole. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. First, Governor Evers' Task Force on Broadband Internet is calling for more funding for a state grant program meant to expand high-speed web access. Wisconsin has allocated about $60 million for high-speed internet over the last 2 years. During a visit to La Crosse last week, President Biden also talked about broadband internet as a key part of his infrastructure plan.
This will also help high-speed internet and make sure it's available to every American home, including 35% of rural families who currently go without it.
Here in Wisconsin, it's estimated that as many as 25% of the rural population lacks access to a high-speed connection. And in some cases, people can't afford the service even if it's available. We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. Are you still in need of a high-speed internet connection in your area? What options do you have for internet? If you run a business online or attend school virtually, could you do it without broadband? Do you think grants and incentives from the state are a good way to extend coverage? What would you like to see in terms of high-speed internet in your area? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rick Barrett is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering this issue in the Journal Sentinel series called Disconnected. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, JC.
So let's start out by understanding the technical side of broadband. Can you remind us what distinguishes it from older connections and what that means in practical terms for the speeds people can actually get online?
Sure. In technical terms, broadband is defined by the Federal Communications Commission as a download speed of 25 megabits per second and uploads of 3 megabit per second. And what that means, you know, for most folks is that if you're an individual, you're working from home, you're taking an online class, those speeds are probably sufficient. 25 megabits per second download, again, and 3 megabit per second uploads, you can do those things pretty well. However, if you're a family and you've got, you know, you're online, your spouse is online, your kids are online, you're all trying to do things during the day or the evening, those speeds are going to struggle and you're going to have some issues. Now, for the folks who don't have true broadband speed, if it's less than 25.3, and there's a lot of that in Wisconsin, for them, it's going to be very difficult for things like posting a video to on a website. Even doing video conferences and such can really be a challenge at some of the slower speeds.
Yeah, and actually, in reading your article, there's a visual in the article that shows you what it looks like when you're looking at the varying speeds. You know, broadband that most people are, most people in rural areas that have, not rural, urban areas that have access to it, and you go through three speeds, and it shows how slowly you might see YouTube load in rural areas. And I was sitting there getting really frustrated on behalf of our friends and neighbors in rural areas. It was really, really slow. You know, what do you think it means for, I mean, we'll talk about the economic impact, but just knowing that there are areas in the state where people don't have access to this, does it feel like the people living there feel like they're getting left behind in some ways?
Yeah, I think they do feel like they're left behind somewhat, JC. I mean, if you're trying to, you know, work from home, especially, in some cases you just can't do it. I mean, I've talked with people who actually are renting an office in a smaller town somewhere nearby so they can drive there every day to work because, you know, they can't work from home. They're just unable to upload the materials they need. They're unable to do those video conferences. And so they'll rent a space in town and go online that way. And for, you know, for students, it's been a huge problem in some areas. You know, we've talked to school districts where one in four of the families, you know, can't even get online. They don't have home internet access. And some school districts, it's as high as, you know, 50% of the students just don't have access. And those kids are really hurting, you know, in terms of being able to keep up with their schoolwork.
I mean, 50%, that's not nothing. It's not like it's 5%. It's 50%, if I'm hearing you correctly, right?
Yeah, that's probably just a handful of places. But, you know, for those communities, you know, the kids are definitely struggling.
All right. We are talking to Rick Barrett right now. He's a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the lack of access to high-speed internet throughout Wisconsin, but especially in rural areas. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has a series called Disconnected, and I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for bringing up this topic. I don't want to say harassing, but I have definitely, every time I saw Congressman Duffy, and every time I see Congressman Tiffany, the entire 7th Congressional District up here is totally being neglected. The internet has been with us for 20 years. And this is why I think Biden is going about it the wrong way. If the federal government wants to be effective and provide internet access to every American, they should be going through congressional districts, not through state government. And the reason I say this is state government drags their feet. It's about money with the state, and every state employee thinks they are privileged because they are employed by the state, by their fellow citizens. So you got to go federal with this to get it effective and get it done quickly. The state government is going to drag its feet like they've proven in the past. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you so much for that call. So Jeff is saying that basically at this point, we need to have the federal government take care of it, go through congressional districts and not, you know, allocate or delegate to state governments. Have you heard similar cases or calls for that at all, Rick?
Well, there's already a lot of federal money that comes into Wisconsin for broadband expansion. There's the Connect America Fund grants, the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund that's been launched. Lots and lots of federal money has flowed into the state. So it's with mixed results. I mean, there are some places where the grant recipients only had to offer, 10 megabits per second downloads, 1 megabit per second uploads. Not even half the FCC's definition of broadband that was set 6 years ago. So I guess I would say that the federal money has come into the state. Some of it has done some good, but as Jeff said, a lot of people are really frustrated, whether it's with the state grants or the federal grants. I think there's room for a lot of improvement.
And so this calls to mind something that you did write about in your article, which is that, there was a project, a huge infrastructure project in the 30s that brought electricity to rural areas. You know, can you talk a little bit about that and really what it did for these areas?
Sure. A lot of people have drawn comparisons with the Rural Electrification Act of 1936. And that was one of the most profound changes in America. I mean, that began like 85 years ago. Electricity was finally extended to the countryside. And, it came as part of an economic stimulus package that Congress passed. And they really wanted to spur that development, electric power, even the places that were far off the grid. I mean, it was a cornerstone of President Roosevelt's New Deal program. It allowed the federal government to make low-interest loans to farmers who had banded together to form not-for-profit electric cooperatives. And that assistance was needed because running those wires in the areas with few homes per mile wasn't profitable for the private investors. And you see a lot of parallels today because, the cost of getting, fiber cable to rural areas can be $20,000 to $30,000 a mile. And in sparsely populated communities, that just doesn't add up for the private investors.
We are talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Rick Barrett right now. We're looking at broadband internet gaps in Wisconsin and what high-speed internet means for those who have it, and really what it also means to those who do not have access to it. Right now, we were just talking about the cost. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What options do you have for internet in your area? Have slow internet speeds caused problems for you? Do you think broadband is something that the state and federal governments should be investing in? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we will continue this conversation and hopefully hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Rick Barrett, business reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about broadband internet coverage in Wisconsin, really who has it, who doesn't, and the difference it can make in people's lives. And you can join in right now at 800-642-1234. And Rick, before the break, we were talking about the cost. And we were referencing a project in the 1930s about bringing electricity to rural areas. But looking at broadband, what kind of construction has to happen to actually bring, broadband to these communities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it varies a lot from place to place. I mean, the perfect solution would be to have fiber cable, you know, to every single home and every single business in a rural area, because that's where you get the highest speeds, the most future-proof service, the most reliability. It's just the gold standard. And that's what a lot of communities would like to have. However, it's just not practical when you get into some of these areas where there are only a couple of people per square mile, or maybe they're more than that, but it just doesn't justify the cost. So other ways of doing it are still okay. I mean, you can use wireless technologies where they set up, you know, transmitters on towers. Even put them on barn silos in tall buildings, and those will send out a signal to the surrounding area and get the internet to these homes and businesses. But even then, you know, you've got to have fiber, you know, to those locations so they have a signal to send out. It's a very costly endeavor no matter how you do it.
Yeah, and I want to actually go to a caller now who is curious to learn more or to talk about another alternative that's out there. We have Lori in Iowa County. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
And what did you want to talk about?
I am in very rural Iowa County where there's nothing available. For many years, I had basically the data that was on my phone. So I even looked into, you know, satellite options, which were pretty pricey and not, I don't think you were going to get a very good value. Well, last fall, I signed up for Starlink. It's the Elon Musk started the company. It's the low orbit satellites, and it's amazing. The upload and download speeds are equal to what my daughters have in the cities that they live.
Lori, thank you so much for that call. So, you know, she's presenting this other alternative, which is Starlink from Elon Musk's company. That's a private company offering this service, very much the way other internet service providers are also private. What have you heard, if anything, from people in rural areas who are signing up for something like Starlink?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've talked with the beta testers for Starlink in Wisconsin. And the ones who I've spoken with have been very satisfied with it. I mean, they're just pleased because they're getting so much better service than they had before. And it's just way beyond what conventional satellite service can offer. So the good news is, you know, the download speeds are phenomenal. The upload speeds are really good. It works well in all types of weather. I mean, even during the blizzards last winter, you know, Starlink was holding pretty good. What we don't know yet is what will happen, you know, when hundreds of thousands of people eventually get on the system. Will they be able to maintain those speeds? A lot of people are saying maybe not. I mean, even now in some places where there are a lot of Starlink users, the speeds are varying quite a bit, and, you know, they tend to drop off. So I think it's still a little bit of a wait and see. But the technology definitely has a lot of promise. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's just that I think the jury is still out on some things. The
yeah.
other thing about that, you know, in Starlink is a great option for many people, but it's also probably too expensive for many people too. I mean, right now it's $99 a month plus $500 for the equipment. So, you know, for a lot of families, that's just out of their reach.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty hefty upfront investment, and then, you know, $100-ish a month after that, just to have access to the internet. And that's something that you also looked into, is the cost being prohibitive in many areas, even if they have access, if broadband or cable is already available. What did you find for, you know, people who might live in Milwaukee and their access to broadband?
Yeah, it's a really good question, JC, because, you know, there are lots of folks who are living in Milwaukee, they're living in Madison, they're living in Eau Claire, they're living in Stevens Point, you know, where there's plenty of service. I mean, that's not the issue. But if you can't afford it, it doesn't do you any good. I mean, people are expected to pay $40, $50, $60 a month, and they can't afford that, well, then the service might as well not even be there. There have been studies done, like from the Pew Research Center, that showed a lot of people can only afford $10, $15 a month. I mean, that's what's in their budget that they could afford. And unless you're part of some subsidized program, that's pretty hard to get.
So outside of a subsidized program, you know, access and the cost of broadband is nothing new. We've had we've talked about this a lot on our program, on other programs. This is clearly a big issue. Do you think that there's any sort of political will, maybe public-private partnership, that could maybe treat broadband like a utility versus what sometimes feels like, you know, something that some people have and some people don't have?
Yeah, again, that's a very good point. I mean, some people already have said, and I think they've made a very strong case, that broadband should be treated as a utility. You know, it's just like electricity. It's just like water. It's just like, you know, having your basic utilities in your home. Broadband could be the fourth utility. But for, you know, so many folks right now, it's just too expensive. And if they could get the cost down for families, it would definitely, you know, make it so much easier for them.
So we only have a couple of minutes left, and I really quickly wanted to talk about some of the other reporting that you did about the communities or maybe even businesses that did decide, hey, we want to invest in you know, the infrastructure, get the cable lines you know, put into the ground in places that we might not think would have broadband access, places like, you know, Vilas County, pretty far up north. You know, what did you hear from these communities that did end up having access to broadband?
I think what I found in my reporting is that some communities were really aggressive about it. I mean, they pursued the state grants, they pursued the federal grants. They went after every dollar that they could get, and they were able to ramp things up, you know, in terms of the service that's available in their area. That takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And some counties, you know, it wouldn't even make a difference, because unless the broadband service provider is even interested in your area, all the pleading in the world isn't going to help.
Well, Rick, we will have to leave it there. There's still so much that we could talk about. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Rick Barrett is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about ongoing issues faced by many Wisconsinites to get access to broadband internet. This is high-speed internet that a lot of people have come to rely on over the last year and a half during the pandemic as people moved to doing just about everything online, from schoolwork, meetings, and more. You can still join the conversation. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and you can find a link to Rick's reporting with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That's called Disconnected. That's a series. You can go to wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest political news from Washington, D.C. as part of our weekly Week in Washington segment. We talk to McClatchy White House correspondent Francesca Chambers, that's a familiar name to many of our listeners, about where the White House is at in terms of its national COVID-19 vaccination goals. And camping is a great way to get involved. We'll learn more tomorrow on Central Time. So today is a big day for fans of the Netflix sketch comedy show I Think You Should Leave. After 2 years, the second season was released today, and the show basically follows everyday situations to their extreme comedic ends. For example, a game of charades where one guest just does not understand how it works. I can't go into all the details, one, because they're super funny, but some of them are a little blue. So one word of warning, the show is not for kids. But that said, I am a fan, and so is producer Jana Rose Schleiss. Hi, Jana Rose.
Hey, JC.
All right. So tell me about one of your favorite sketches.
So what I love about this show is, like you said, it takes these mundane interactions to their absolute extreme, and they become so uncomfortable and I think hilarious. And one of my favorite sketches is when our protagonist, played by Tim Robinson, is on a first date, splitting an appetizer of nachos, and he notices that his date is eating all of the fully loaded nachos, you know, the ones with all the meat and the cheese and the other good stuff. I can imagine if you or I were in this situation, we'd maybe be annoyed, but we certainly wouldn't address it. Well, Tim does. He even tries to get the waiter involved to stop his date from stealing all the best bites of nachos. And in an attempt to garner sympathy, he says one of my favorite lines, "I'm basically getting, like, just chipped."
Yeah, that's basically what this show is about. Uncomfortable to the extreme. Thanks, Jana Rose.